Why the continued fascination with World War II? Well, that's one of our topics this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. I'm your host, John Pierce. Glad to have you listening in this evening. And our Director of Operations, Neil Heaver, is our engineer this evening. My guest is Dr. Robert Wiener, who is Thomas Roy and Laura Jones Professor of History and Jewish chaplain at Lafayette College. In fact, just recently retired. And Bob, you told me after how many years at Lafayette?
Just 50.
Only 50.
Getting used to it.
It's almost a career.
Almost.
So we're going to be exploring, well, the lead up to World War II, what happened with these dictators who were involved. How about the entre-guerres, which, as the French would call it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Between World Wars I and II. So let's begin with this question, Bob, about the fascination with issues associated with World War II. Why does that continue to this day?
I suppose there are several reasons, and I can just go with my own fascination, I suppose, because I keep reading and rereading and rereading these massive tomes that come out and love teaching them also. My guess is that one reason is the over-life-sized and grotesque figure of Hitler, who is real but beyond belief. And I think there's a far, far greater fascination in the public with his persona than with someone like Mussolini or even Stalin, who was responsible before the war for 10 times, 20 times more deaths in his own society. But there is that overwhelming figure of Hitler. I think some of it has to do with the Munich syndrome, which has come down historically as a warning of what not to do. But it's only a useful warning if you evaluate it very, very carefully, because no two situations are ever going to be exactly the same. But the idea of appeasement, the idea that as late as 1935, France had so much more power still than Germany. But by 1939, the balance of power had really, really changed. And how is that possible? That a country like France that had fought really well in World War I, as did Germany fight extremely well in World War I, how did it come apart the way it came apart? And that wasn't necessarily going to happen. There is a lot of contingency here. And then I think another reason perhaps has to do with the aesthetics of photography and newsreels. This one we have so much information on. It can be brought so close to home. And then it gets merged with the Holocaust, which is easily as grotesque as the war itself, and the two form a kind of continuum. They're part of the same process. And that is also something that is so real and so unglaublich, so unbelievable in the 20th century. So, and I'm sure others would come up with many, many other reasons why this is the case.
Do you have any thoughts about if Hitler had not been the head of Germany at that point, whether there would have been a Holocaust?
I don't think so. There were many, many other National Socialists as racially motivated, ideologically motivated, in what was a belief system, a kind of religion, a Darwinian religion of survival of the fittest, with the most bizarre element of all in this huge racial hierarchy being that the Jews were bacteria and vermin that would destroy the body if you didn't get rid of them, to the last one. That's only the most extreme element of a whole racial category in which tens of millions of Slavs would have been murdered had Germany won the war. Hitler, again, internally had a level of authority and power that was almost beyond belief, especially after the Night of the Long Knives, June 1934, when he had Rehm of the SA and a number of other people murdered, and then took full credit for doing it the next day, saying, "I am the supreme justiciar of the German people. I will protect the Volk from its enemies." And these people were enemies, and therefore I did what I needed to do. By 1938, he even took down the leaders of the military in changing both the Minister of War and the Commander-in-Chief of the Army and replacing them with his own appointees. No one had that level of authority in Germany, and almost no one was that extreme. And in addition to that, well, the war was the best time to do something like that, but it was also the worst time to do it because it was costly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and again, not just in terms of the Holocaust, but the entire racial policy was self-destructive. If Germany had been able to delay that until after the war in some fashion, there were tens of millions of ethnics in Eastern Europe who would gladly have fought against Russian communism with the German forces, and many did anyway. But Hitler, once the war began the process that Alan Bullock, one of the oldest biographers, Hitler, A Study in Tyranny, calls, ironically, the undressing of Hitler. One of the chapters is called The Emperor Without His Clothes, in which he ceased being euphemistic and really wanted to do it his way and let everyone behold it and not have to hide anymore and do exactly what he wanted to do, and the devil take the rest. It backed up. It backed up on him. So it is possible, but it is unlikely, and it's also unlikely that there would have been a World War II without an Adolf Hitler.
Wow.
Unlikely, especially with the attack on the Soviet Union. Possibly a war in the West, but the attack on the Soviet Union, that's unbelievable.
Wow. You mentioned the appeasement at the conference in Munich. So that leads to a question, are there any lessons to be learned from the origins of World War II, especially the doctrine or policy of appeasement?
Well, that's quite a question, especially today, because this is one of the anniversaries of the Anschluss in 1938 and, of course, in Munich in September of 1938. There are always lessons, but sometimes the lesson from the past war doesn't work for the next one. My sense, ultimately, the lesson is not that appeasement never works, because appeasement means pacification, conciliation. For it to work, the individual you're working with has to be appeasable, capable of being appeased, capable of saying, that's enough, now I've gotten what I want, and we can stop at this. In this particular case, that was a radical error in judgment on the part of the British, not the French. They were dragged along They weren't ready to fight alone without the British. They didn't expect it to work in the long run, but they were buying time. My judgment is that what one has to learn from something like this is you always have to be cognizant of a worst-case scenario. What if you're wrong? What if you are wrong? And the British were not working on two tracks. They were not rearming appropriately. And the French were not rearming sufficiently. So all the way until 1938, 1939, Germany is spending more than Britain and France together in rearming.
Uh-huh.
So they were not using that time well.
Right. Let's go back to the idea that we had a World War 1914 to 18. The U.S. jumped in 1917. And then we had a war about 20 years later. And I suppose at that point people were wondering, are we going to have a war every 20 years? And it didn't happen. Thank goodness.
Right.
But those are the two big wars of the 20th century. How do you analyze the world getting into World War I versus World War II?
Well, I'll start with the thereafter first. As strange as that is, nuclear weapons is probably more than any other reason why we didn't have another one afterwards. Nuclear weapons, the cloud, the image of our age has taken on the shape of the deity. It's not that we've changed, it's that we have so far still somewhat of a better idea of what would happen if we had another one. But the two wars are sometimes called the 30 Years' War, second time around from Germany in from the 17th century, 1618 to 1648. That's somewhat of a useful categorization, except I think that in the second 20-year era, the major difference that really led to the possibility of the Second War in the shape it took was the Great Depression. No Great Depression, no Adolf Hitler. Not possible for someone like him to come to power in Germany, a corporal in a state still governed by the old elite, someone who was really an outsider. And that was he had been trying to move forward for 8 years by then and not getting very, very far until the Depression. In the last election before the Depression, the National Socialists had 12 seats in a parliament of over 500 seats. So, but the main difference between the wars, of course, is that World War I is so much more complicated because multiple powers share guilt on some level, even if perhaps Germany did deserve, together with the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the greatest portion. But in World War II, it's a different kind of situation. One party bears the overwhelming guilt, agency, they would say today, because he wanted war, and he intended to have a war. The others share a different kind of responsibility, which is the guilt of omission. This is a time period I sometimes call a perfect storm. Historically, British foreign policy has usually been relatively intelligent and capable of defending the empire. Historically, the French, although not always, have done pretty well militarily. In this time period, you have perhaps the single worst foreign policy on behalf of Britain that it ever had, given the situation it faced. And in the case of France, perhaps the single worst military posture that it ever had, and that in both cases, in foreign policy and in military policy, the elites held to those policies and threw out anyone else who disagreed with them with such levels of categorical feeling that that it made no sense whatsoever. And what's again ironic is that there were people who were warning them. In the case of Britain, by 1936, you have the beginning of the real wakening up of Winston Churchill. And the more he warns them that they have to rearm and that their policy is probably not correct, and that they must follow more multiple policy options, they ostracize him worse. In the case of France, in some ways, it's even more decisive because Charles de Gaulle writes a book in 1934. He's a young colonel. Okay. He dedicates the book to General Pétain, his mentor, and it's called Toward the Army of the Future, or Toward a Professional Army is the real translation. And de Gaulle says, okay, the Maginot Line is of some use, but it's only of use as part of a policy, part of a posture. Every army must also know how to attack. And what we have to do is use our tanks as a separate attack force. And he describes how one does that with a small professional army, very much like what the Germans did later, because they copied much of what he said, and they added dive bombers to the scenario. So the French had a clear option. There was a French politician similar to Churchill, not as powerful, but his name was Paul Reynaud. He brings this to the Chamber of Deputies. It's debated. De Gaulle's military option is debated. And both the Minister of War and the head of the army, under the guidance of Pétain, come in full court press against any of these changes. And the Minister of War says, when we have spent so many millions on our fortifications, who would believe us foolish enough to sally out in front of them in search of heaven knows what adventure? That's a general speaking. It makes no sense. De Gaulle wasn't saying change your entire policy. He is saying modify it. We have allies in Eastern Europe on the east of Germany. How can we protect them if all we have is a defensive army? So they were given an opportunity, and they vote it down, and they push him into the outside, and he's an outlier until the war begins. So they're both alerted. They both had options. But the options, and this goes back to your initial question, the options force these people to face the possibility of another World War I. And that's where one understands the trauma of World War I. To me, I don't understand their thinking without factoring in the psychological devastation of World War I, the unwillingness to even think about doing it again.
With so many lives lost.
Yes.
My guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse is Dr. Robert Wiener, who has been professor at Lafayette College for 50 years, and also, professor of history and also Jewish chaplain there. We're going to continue our discussion of World War II after this short break. Stay with us.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
And I'd like to pause in our discussion of World War II to tell you that Dr. Robert Wiener was born and raised in Philadelphia, married, family at a young age. Let's give a shout out to Sandra Faye Wiener, whom you have come to
Hooray!
Know very, very well throughout the years. You have three sons and four grandsons. So Dr. Wiener has an AB Temple University, plus Hebrew teacher's certificate from Gratz Hebrew College, also Philadelphia. Is the Gratz Hebrew College connected with a Gratz High School?
No, not at all. Totally
same name.
Same name.
Okay.
This is a Rebecca Gratz, who was a way ahead of her time in educational theory in the early 19th century in Philadelphia.
Uh-huh.
Sunday school movement. We all need that.
Yeah, and then you went on to for a PhD at Rutgers, and your main teaching and research fields are modern Europe, modern France, modern Jewish history, Holocaust studies, and oral history. Many articles and several authored and co-authored books, especially The Long 19th Century and An Uncertain Future, Voices of French Jews, The Jews of Dijon. You've narrowed your focus to that one city in France.
Yes, with great joy, because they had a language institute. And I took Lafayette students twice in 1993 and in 2000, 5 months each time. But after 1993, I have been back to Dijon at least once every single year, except for 1 year, because I have so many friends there. It's such a great place.
Wow, that is frequent visitation.
Yes, I love it.
Yes, you do. So, Bob Wiener, in as much as Hitler's designs, you talked quite a bit about the importance of Hitler in our first segment. His designs and worldview were so clearly revealed by the mid-1920s in Mein Kampf and later speeches. How could he be taken seriously, especially by German elites?
That's a great question, and it's a question that elicits and provokes tremendous sadness on my part, because he was not alone. He is an extreme, radical representative of one of the main threads in European and American culture at the end of the 19th century, especially as it is radicalized through the prism of both World War I and the Bolshevik Revolution. The culture of radical social Darwinian racial categories. The culture that believed that war was not only occasional in human history, but on the part of many, essential for even the improvement of culture and the survival of the species.
Which means the elimination of some of the people.
Which means the elimination of other people who have less deserving rights to exist because they're inferior. And if you're part of the superior racial category, it's almost your responsibility to carry this out. And that's where some of the differences occur. For example, Teddy Roosevelt had some of those same beliefs, but he believed in peace. But if you're going to fight, then fight like hell. But still, hold it in. In the late 19th century, there was a German general in 1911, who wrote a book entitled Germany and the Next War, in which he said the German people are too bourgeois, too businesslike, too passive, too calm. They need a radical leader. I need to prove to them that they need a greater empire, and that is the will of nature and the nature of reality. Well, at the same time, you've got French Catholic elitist university students saying the exact same thing, that the generation before us, our parents, were cowardly because they didn't attack Germany in the 1880s and regain Alsace-Lorraine. We are ready to shed our lives to do so. You've got the Italian futurists saying the same thing. War is glory. War is creativity. No one over 30 years of age needs to be considered very much. Neither are women worth very much. because they're not capable of action and courage and warfare. So this isn't German culture, although German culture was part and parcel of it. This is European-wide culture as a major thread of the culture. I won't even call it the counterculture, but as a major possibility. In other words, someone like Hitler or Mussolini emerges out of an already existing major cultural tradition and trope, only made worse by the war, the Russian Revolution, the radical inflation of the early 1920s, and then finally the Great Depression. So, to get directly to your question, what he was saying was not foreign to the ears of many of the elites. It was just more extreme than some of their own thoughts. They were mostly militarist. They were mostly racialist. They were mostly anti-Semitic, although not all. They all believed that the Treaty of Versailles needed to be revised and that Germany was mistreated at the end of World War I. They all were terrified of Bolshevism and socialism. But beyond that, they also mostly despised democracy and liberal parliamentary government. Adolf Hitler was not part of their group, but he was speaking their language in a more radical way, and they assumed they could control him in the same way as the Italian elites assumed that they could control Mussolini. So did the Italian elites control Mussolini 10 years later from the view of the German elites? No, they didn't, but Mussolini took care of their needs. So the unions and the Bolsheviks and the socialists and the Democrats were either out of the country or in prison or underground and quiet. And the German elites in the depths of the Depression had only one other real option other than radical reform, and that is a military dictatorship. And the military wasn't anxious to do that, so that their best way of maintaining law and order was to bring into power the most lawless and order-breaking group that had hundreds of thousands, indeed millions, of followers, and that was Adolf Hitler, who convinced them that what he said when he was younger is not necessarily what he would do when he was older, and that if he had enemies, they were not his enemies, others were his enemies. Bolsheviks, international capital, meaning Jewish capital, not healthy native German capital.
Right. And you have also mentioned that the Depression, the economic situation had so much to do with World War II coming along. If the economy had been stable and better and rising and so on, perhaps there wouldn't have been a war at all?
I doubt that there would have been a war. Germany would have recovered complete independence of movement. It was already happening. Changes would have occurred, but they need not have occurred militarily. And the only other real potential disturber of the peace in Europe, not to say the Far East where you have Japan, but the only real potential disturber of the peace in Europe was the Soviet Union, and the Soviet policy was defensive at that time. And it was especially defensive since Stalin purged his Army, Navy, and Air Force in 1937, 38, and 39, in some cases down to 50% of the highest officers.
Wow.
So he was buying time, especially after the Spanish Civil War and his purges. Now, those purges are literally insane, but he's paranoid. And the army is the only institution left that can still potentially challenge him for power. Hitler takes control of the army by chopping off the heads, metaphorically, of the military elites. Stalin takes control of the army, navy, air force by literally chopping off the head of the elites. He has them all murdered. And first they have a chance to admit their crimes too. And one does that by threatening their families more than anything else.
Right. So you have Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, their commitment to certain policies. Are they more alike or very, very different, the three of them?
Great question. Tough question. Their means have a lot in common. And prior to the war, Stalin is by far the most extreme because his policies lead to the death of millions through starvation, especially in Ukraine in the early 1930s. Whereas, again, for Hitler, it's Jews and socialists, Bolsheviks, Democrats, anyone who gets in his way. But he does not seek enemies unless they're already there, other than in racial categories, and those racial categories include people unfit to live because they have physical or mental challenges. So actually the first large numbers of people who were killed in what was called the T4 program are hundreds of thousands of people who had illnesses or supposedly had illnesses. Mussolini does not have the intensity of the ideological beliefs that Hitler has. Some scholars say he's only really a pragmatist. I think he did have ideological beliefs, but more than anything else, his belief was in his own power and his need to have that power. Stalin, I think, has strong ideological beliefs, but more than anything else, he has the paranoid need to have complete power and to eliminate anyone who can threaten that power. They all have different ideologies and they all have different tendencies toward adhering or not to those ideologies under times of choice and times of crisis. Hitler held true to his ideology fairly consistently once the war began. He did what people couldn't believe that anyone would do. He did a lot of what he said he was going to do. And others found that unbelievable.
So we're talking about the period of World War II and why we're still fascinated with it and the leading characters in the World War, the Depression leading up to it. And some people have said, I've heard it said, that we extricated ourselves from, talking about the U.S. now, from the Depression by the war.
Thanks for bringing that up, because that's the next point I wanted to make, that the only power that really could have stabilized the situation without inordinate difficulty was the United States, and we were not psychologically and mentally prepared to play the role that history had called upon us to play at that moment, and that's understandable, because our emergence as a great power and even a superpower occurred so quickly as a result of European self-destruction in World War I. From about 1936, Franklin Roosevelt tried to reorient American policy and do as much as he was able to get us to think about our world responsibilities. But in 1936, when Hitler remilitarized the Rhineland, the German-French border, which was illegal according to the Treaty of Versailles, but also illegal according to the 1926 Locarno freely negotiated treaty between Germany, France, Britain, Belgium, Italy. Alan Nevins at Columbia University, one of our great scholars, wrote an article in Current History in the spring of 1936, the last line of which was, "After all, it's only Germany's own backyard. So if the French can militarize their border, why can't the Germans defend themselves and militarize their border?" In 1938, Roosevelt tried a little bit more aggressively to call an international conference and see if the British would be interested in doing it. And Neville Chamberlain, who believed in proactive appeasement, there are two kinds of appeasement in the 30s. One was passive, which was the previous British prime minister. That is, you let things happen and then you pacify them, right? And one was proactive. You identify where the next problems are likely to occur and try to avoid the dictators causing a war over things you're willing to give them to start with. And that was Chamberlain's proactive, active appeasement. Chamberlain doesn't want the conference. He's afraid Roosevelt will spoil his successful policy of appeasing the dictators. And Chamberlain has an inordinate sense of belief in his own capability, which seems to be something that most people who rise to the top tend to have at some level, and it gets them into great deals of difficulty. He won't lie to me to my face. He said that to me. It's got to be true. So after Munich, Chamberlain actually believes it's peace in our time. We shook on it. The French prime minister goes back with a sense of shame. We have neglected an ally ready to fight on our side. We have thrown them to the wolves. And when the people are there to greet Daladier, he is asked, should we fly to another airport instead of Le Bourget? And he says, no, one has to face one's destiny. And they land, and when he comes out of the plane, everybody is cheering him. And Daladier turns to the person next to him, and he says, mais ces gens sont fous, these people are mad. This is temporary. This isn't going to work. We are going to have to fight. We just can't do it right now. We're not ready. The British are not ready.
And that was what year?
That's 38, September 38. Yeah.
World War II is our topic this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Time for us to take another break. Dr. Robert Wiener will be right back, enlightening us on more details of this period in our history. So stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment.
The Many Choices and Real Voices on WDIY are made possible with support from our generous, sustaining members. An automatic monthly gift of $10 on your credit card is an easy way to become a WDIY member and support the programs you love. Set up your monthly sustaining membership gift today. Call 610-694-8100 extension 7 or visit WDIY.org. Thank you.
Dr. Robert Wiener is my guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm John Pierce, your host. Neil Heaver is our operations director, and he is our engineer this evening. So glad to have you tuning in to learn more about World War II and our fascination with it, which continues to this day. Bob, I want to throw in another question about another war, and that is one that is frequently mentioned still to this day, and that's the war in Vietnam.
Yeah.
I find that there's as much fascination about that war as World War II. What do you think?
I don't know. I think perhaps in the United States. I don't know if that is shared globally. When I travel and go to, half a dozen or 10 bookstores in France, which I do every year, or wherever I am going.
You can't stay away from La Fnac.
I cannot stay away from the bookstores. In fact, one of the best is a Catholic bookstore in Paris that is just outstanding. It has everything laid out beautifully right in front of you. You're going to see World War II and World War I really, really powerfully shown. And you'll see Vietnam, I suppose what they might have in common, or even different in a sense, is that Vietnam was not necessary. I remember being a student an undergrad in the 60s, and I was taking a South Asia course with a Chinese faculty member, and we just knew it wasn't going to be good. And it was an example of elites being convinced by the same ideology and propaganda that, in a sense, they were conveying to the masses. The Munich Syndrome appeasement, right? The appeasement of fascism versus the appeasement of communism. But also the, and I'm going to forget this now, I can't remember the exact wording of it, but the domino thesis, of course, the domino effect, right? Now, all you had to do is study the history of Vietnam, and one would know that there is a 1,000-year history of conflict between Vietnam and China. So this is not a uniform international communist movement by the mid-late 1960s. If you want to talk about the Cold War in the 50s, that's slightly different. But the Soviets and the communist Chinese had already had border conflicts in the early 60s.
It took us a long time to realize that there's not just one communist threat out there.
Exactly. Right? And this is mind-boggling, the amount of damage done. And to me, the worst damage done of all is the damage we did to ourselves in undermining the great society and the radical changes that we needed domestically to make our country a better place for everyone to live in. And that was very, very much undermined by Vietnam. And I don't know if we've ever really gotten back to that.
Wow. Plus, we see many veterans still today who fought in that war as opposed to Second World War. We've lost that generation. So, and it does make sense to me that the rest of the world is not going to look upon the Vietnam War as crucial as the others, because mm-hmm. not as many countries involved.
I do know that as a student, graduate student traveling in Europe, it made it harder for me to be accepted in both Britain and France as an American.
Oh.
Absolutely. People were hostile. Some people were hostile.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's get back to the main characters in World War II. We haven't talked very much about Winston Churchill. How does he come into this? You mentioned Neville Chamberlain.
Yes.
And he preceded Churchill.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Churchill was the successor then.
Yeah.
And what would you? How do you rate Winston Churchill's attitude and during the war period?
I remember as an undergraduate reading The Gathering Storm, which is the first volume in his multi-volume history of World War II. And then I was doing a paper on the Rhineland crisis, which is this March 1936 situation. And I was reading the British parliamentary debates, which we had at Temple University. And I realized that Churchill was post facto saying that he had already developed postures that he, in fact, had not yet developed during the Rhineland crisis in 1936. Oh. But after the Rhineland crisis, he did develop those postures. In other words, he says in the book, I really, really pushed the French to take decisive action, which they could have taken, and they could have taken it even alone if they had had the courage and the focus to do it. Really, what he said to the French at that time is, all right, let's talk about this, but you need to be really, really careful, and you need to take this crisis very, very seriously. In retrospect, later, he saw that as a terrible missed opportunity. So he was coming of age, but he had made mistakes both in World War I and earlier that had led people to think of him as a loose cannon, which on a certain level he was, in the same way as Georges Clemenceau, the great French World War I leader, was also a loose cannon, in the sense that when Raymond Poincaré appoints him as prime minister, he says, as long as we could win without him, I would never put him in power. But now that we can't win without him, we need him, I'll take the risk and put him in power. That's how they thought about Churchill.
Uh-huh.
So he had lots of enemies.
There's an interesting book called, maybe the title is Franklin and Winston, or Winston and Franklin, I've forgotten, and how their relationship developed between the two countries, the U.S. and Great Britain. They met several times, and back and forth with their doubts and their questions about, are we doing the right thing and what should we do next, and mm-hmm. so on. But it really makes fascinating reading.
It does. It does. And it makes fascinating video material. I viewed some of that just 3 weeks ago. There's a color World War II video, and there's also a multi-part series by a British scholar named Lawrence Rees called The Nazis, which goes through that whole experience with just tremendous cinematic material.
Well, let's ask the question about Hitler again. Could Hitler have been stopped short of a major war? And if so, at what point would this have been most advantageous and justifiable?
Advantageous, justifiable, possible, we go straight to the Rhineland crisis, which is what I wanted to do my PhD on, but someone from Penn had nabbed the topic before I did a couple of years, right? So I went back and did work on the origins of World War I. But the Rhineland crisis was a time in which a number of things were true and several weren't true. What was true is that Hitler was clearly breaking international law, including law that Germany had signed freely. But not only was he breaking it, but he did so against the wishes of most of the top military leaders who believed that the German army was not ready to defend Germany should the French take this seriously enough and go into the Rhineland. And they believed they would be defeated. This is also, in addition, prior to the time in which the German military came to be mystified by Hitler's seemingly uncanny ability to understand what the British and French would do better than the military could, because had they been the British or the French, they would not have accepted this change of status quo. They would have gone to war over it. And so that there was a possibility, and again, it's only a possibility, that if the German army had been in any way embarrassed and forced to retreat, that the military might have overthrown him, because by that time, he had already done their job for them. That is, the communists were broken, the socialists were broken, the democracy was broken, order had been restored, and Germany was already beginning to come out of the Depression, because the rearming and the public works had gotten the economy onto a better footing, much more so by 1936. Again, in the what might have been category, if the French in 1934 had listened to de Gaulle, by 1936 they would have had separate tank units that could have gone in and pushed back the German army.
Was de Gaulle in effect asking for more money for armaments?
Yes, but again, not radically more money. This is not something that would have been that difficult. A lot of it was reorganization. They had the tanks. He wanted them to be reorganized as separate units that would attack. Oh, rather than as mobile pieces of artillery, they would have a real function.
Oh.
And instead, we have the minutes and we have the memoirs from the French cabinet meetings that took place during the early phases of the Rhineland crisis, in which the politicians say to the military, what is your policy? What should we do at this point? Pierre Étienne Flandin asks General Gamelin, what should we do? And the general says, It's not my business to tell you what to do. It's your business to tell me what to do. And Flandin says, well, what military plans do you have in place for this possibility that has occurred? And the military says, none at the moment except general mobilization during the Depression. Now, there is still a member in that meeting who says, I don't want to hear about anything. All I want to know is how fast can we invade? But what they do is end up saying, since no one has a plan, no one has a contingency, let's go talk to our allies, the Brits, which is certainly going to lead nowhere because the Brits were already making it clear that they didn't want an aggressive policy in response to any of these German actions. So that's why this Rhineland crisis is so important. A year later, by 1937, the middle of 1937, the Germans have built the Siegfried Line facing the French. The Belgians have declared the neutrality. The Romanians have fired their pro-French foreign minister and replaced him with a pro-German foreign minister. Huh. The psychological balance of power has changed. A year later, any invasion of Germany would have been very, very costly to the French. In March of 1936, the German army was not fully developed at all. The French had the capability, but it was not organized in a fashion that could attack because they had never conceived of the idea that they would attack. And that's preposterous.
Was their attitude in France simply that one of defense?
Yes.
And not of attack?
Yes. Because attack caused so much death in World War I, and defense saves lives. And so even after that occurs, you have people even such as Leon Blum, who was very self-critical. He said afterwards, I felt like a coward, but I'm glad we didn't go to war. People felt relief that it didn't lead to a war, but they knew something was wrong. But they didn't take the responsibility for correcting what was wrong. The French were still debating what model fighter aircraft to develop, while the Germans are simply producing aircraft. French have the same industrial capacity just about at that point. They have the same number of tanks. They just don't put it in the right structure. So it's not enough just to have stuff. You have to know how to use it.
And if you're discussing what kind of airplanes to develop, that's not going to be this year or next year.
That's not going to be this
year. It's going to take a while.
So Hitler keeps building more airplanes than Britain and France combined until about 1940. And then you know the British outbuild the Germans for a while. How can they outbuild them in 1941 if they couldn't outbuild them in 1936 and 1937?
They just weren't ready at that time.
They weren't ready. Baldwin gave a speech and he said, the bomber will always get through. No matter what we do, our cities will be bombed. That's a psychological statement of tremendous importance.
Yes, indeed. There was a speech that I think it's fairly famous that Winston Churchill gave, to go back to Churchill, and it was it at his prep school that he was addressing the graduates of that year, and his total speech was, never, never, never give up. I don't know if that is, if that particular speech is
sounds
so
like
famous,
him.
But yes. And I thought to myself, if that isn't the best example of less is more.
Right.
I don't know what is.
Well, that's what Charles de Gaulle in his first speech to the French said. He said, we have been defeated by a greater technological force. We have technology also, and we will defeat them when we develop our technology. Hang in.
Hang in. World War II. Yes. Complications. And you have said something today, Bob Wiener, that I never had thought about, and that is some people considering from World War I through World War II as another 30 years war,
mm-hmm.
as in the 17th century. Mm-hmm. Never thought about it like that.
Yeah.
As if the Second World War kind of finished what was left undone from the First World War.
Yes, yes.
With different dynamics going on,
mm-hmm.
Different reasons. Believe it or not, our time is up.
Wow.
Dr. Wiener just gets such a pleasure out of talking about history.
My pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. And I'm sure I don't have to remind his wife, looking for her name here.
Sandra Fay,
that you love to talk history, because I bet you talk it at home. Do you?
I'm given limited time allocations for that. But when she's sleeping, I talk.
Have you told her yet that you are programmed to go for about 2.5 hours with the class?
Sandy knows that.
Yes, she knows. She's already
snoring. She's my favorite classroom.
There you go. Thank you so much for coming by again. This is the second time that I've had the pleasure to chat with Dr. Robert Wiener. Bob, we wish you really, really good luck in your retirement.
Thank you, John.
50-year career at Lafayette College. Congratulations and best wishes.
Thank you, sir.
From all of us here at WDIY.
Merci beaucoup, mon ami.
C'est mon plaisir. And that does it for Lehigh Valley Discourse for this evening. Thanks so much for tuning in. Thank you, Neil Heaver, for engineering for us. And my name is John Pierce. Remember, as you think about history, to be gentle with your neighbor.